My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome back to The Messy Truth, Conversations on Photography. I'm honored to have Laya Abril on the show today. Laya is a research-based artist working in photography, text, video, and sound. She began her career at the iconic Colors magazine, which left an indelible mark on how she thinks about process, authorship, and collaboration. Now her artwork is centered on creating a dialogue around the hidden realities related to sexuality and gender inequality. In this episode, we talk about her long-term project, A History of Misogyny. Chapter 1 on abortion is a gut-wrenching exploration of the repercussions of not having access to abortion. And in her latest chapter, on rape, she aims to call out institutionalized rape culture. She looks at why structures of justice, law, and policy are not only failing survivors, but actually encouraging perpetrators by preserving power dynamics which normalize sexual violence. In this episode, we talk about her methodology, how it has evolved over time, how she thinks about audience, and how she navigates the emotional weight of the subject matter she's dealing with. For me, Laya is one of the most important artists working today. Her work is about starting vital conversations around urgent issues to play her role in creating a more empathetic and safe world. The content of this podcast could be triggering for some listeners. We discuss topics including eating disorders, sexual violence, abortion, child abuse, and trauma. Do take care if this episode could be harmful for you. Thanks for listening. I'm so curious to hear about your time at Colors, where you worked as a researcher, staff photographer, and a photo editor for 5 years, because I'm such a huge fan of the magazine. It really is a very, very special publication, and it has this really rich and kind of layered way of storytelling. And I'd love to hear about your experiences there and how they shaped your own approach and kind of methodologies of working.
Yeah, I guess Colors was indeed my school. Like I end up studying journalism, but really because I didn't really know what I wanted to do, because I wanted to do everything. Like, I think journalism was my card to get inside other people's lives. No, it sounds really like a cliche, but it was true. And in a way, when I was doing journalism, I was very lucky to find Colors and to find Olivia Toscani's work, and I was obsessed with it. I was obsessed with it to the point that I decided that was going to be where I was going to work. And it took me a few years to manage to get there. And that was my school, because it was kind of where I understood that design and production and photography and text and film, and they were only tools in order for us to tell what we wanted to tell. And in that case, were the stories we were telling. In my case now, the stories I am telling. So also being surrounded by people from all over the world, very young people, very talented people, it was pretty much where I developed my methodology of work. Obviously, that has changed with the time, but still to this day, the people I work with, like my editor, my video editor, my designer, they were colleagues at Colors or at Fabrica, which is the residency where Colors was placed in the northern of Italy. Yeah, it was a pretty wild experience. I only remember the nice things, but it was also pretty intense at the beginning because we didn't have internet at home, we didn't have iPhones. So we were quite isolated in the middle of nowhere in Italy. And we were pretty much working every day. It was the most productive time of my life.
But Colors also has this really exciting dynamic around teamwork as well, right? Kind of breaking down and sort of reimagining ideas of ownership and authorship of work, which feels like as well something that you've kind of carried through into your own practice in terms of unraveling subject matter with multiple voices.
Yeah, like when I'm in the methodology, obviously the way we were researching, that's also part of it. But basically this kind of concept of teamwork is a very big part of it. Like if you take a look to a Colors, for instance, the text is not credited. And I think that was really interesting, no? Because coming from journalism, even from documentary photography, which is this very individualistic world, and obviously to credit photographers, it's very important. I'm not saying it's not. But at the end of the day, the way we were working, everybody was pitching ideas, even the design department. Even I was pitching ideas to the design department. It was really horizontal in the way we were working. So at the end of the day, the text that you are reading, is it the text from, you know, is the credit for the, should be the credit for the writer, or should be for the person who pitched it, or the person who researched it, or the person who did the interview, or the one that was translating or editing or fixing it? So yeah, it was pretty much everybody's work. And with photography it was exactly the same. When I was a photo editor, I was assigning photographers with such a very tailored briefs that it was, and I was, they were mostly stories that I researched myself, that at the end of the day, you know, like, is the photographer the owner of the picture? Because he, you know, like, it's just, I believe was a shared credit in many cases. And nowadays in my work, I believe it's the same. Like, I work with a lot of people and I feel I share the credit with a lot of people who work with me, and it's obviously not only myself doing it. And you know, it was also very interesting to navigate the ego of my own photography when the first day I arrived with my first assignment and they didn't use it because, you know, the art direction was not like fitting the art direction, even though the pictures were good. So those kinds of moments were the ones that taught me, you know, it's not about your picture, it's not about what you've done, it's about the story. So that was pretty much my school, my learning process. Yeah.
I'm really interested in your kind of unique process of slow storytelling, because your work is obviously incredibly layered and complex. And what I've always been fascinated by is the way when you talk about your work, you make it very clear that this approach did not just happen overnight. It's been this sustained long-term commitment to your practice, to ideas of trial and error. And all of those decisions and strategies and learnings you've employed over time have kind of laddered to this incredibly rich work. And I wondered how you've developed or kind of cultivated the confidence and resilience to really trust in your process, because it's not easy to do.
No, it's not. Trust and confidence. I guess what I've realized lately is the fact that it's not about the result. And I guess that's also kind of parallel to what I was telling about Colors. And in my case, it's a little bit more obvious because it's a journey, no? Like when I start working on abortion or on rape, I don't really know much about it. Like, obviously I know, but not to the point that I know after when I finish the project. So what it detonates for me, or what it triggers for me to focus in one chapter or in one topic lately, is pretty much connected to a need of understanding. And that process of, again, learning and researching and understanding and connecting, it's pretty much what takes me to the visualization and the end result, which happens obviously like at the end of it. So during the process, everything that I do, and this is also something I do when I work with my designer, Ramon Pez, we work in this particular way. I call it the ping-pong kind of methodology. It's like questioning all the time, like if it makes sense what we are doing, especially when you're working with very sensitive topics. You know, there is always this danger of using too much aesthetics or getting too shallow about some aspects, because at the end of the day, we are working with artistic tools. So for me, the process of criticizing myself, or I wouldn't say criticizing, but like kind of confronting myself with every decision that I take, is what at the end of the day I'm a little bit more calm in the way that, okay, even though, you know, this is not the only way how things should be done, or might not be the best way, at least it has been a process in which we have reflected on every step of the way. And that's very organic, no? And it's kind of complex when you work with long-term projects, because, for instance, now when I talk about on abortion, I did the research and the production 5 years ago, which is, you know, a long time, especially in the late years that everything changed so much. And the fact that it's still consistent and I'm still okay defending the project. I mean, maybe not 100%, but, you know, it's clear that methodology worked. And when it's not, which happens, because again, the world is changing very rapidly, as much as I can, I also face it and I also change it, no? Especially with shows, which is easier, obviously, than books. So that kind of like allowing myself to not fail, but being able to understand that things are in a constant process and evolution, in a way, I think that's what makes the project possible to survive for so many years. I don't know if that makes more sense. That makes sense.
Yeah, it really does. It really does. And it's interesting that, you know, you mentioned sort of this kind of obsession people have with the final manifestation of the work. And it's interesting because in your work, the research is also very much the work. It's the critical element that everything hangs upon. Can you talk about your approach to research and kind of the role of the internet within your practice? Because it feels so powerful in terms of how it brings everything together.
Yeah, I guess I'm a daughter of internet and the first social media and the Facebook generation, and I've always been very grateful, actually, because the kind of stories that I want to tell, they are not the stories that you find walking in the street. So it's always been thanks to internet and social network that I have found my character. So I'm quite grateful of being from this generation. The research is really the most organic part of the process, no? Because I studied journalism, and people tend to think that that's the kind of research that I do. And I didn't really learn much research when I was studying journalism. I actually learned about researching at Colors. And the way we were researching at Colors was not the strict journalistic methodology. So during these years, I've been mixing it up with, you know, other systems and other kind of sources. And slowly it's kind of getting transformed to a more personal research in which I actually face very hard information and I decided to react to it in a visual way. And it's hard for me to explain this because this is what I've done in the latest project on rape, but it's already different the way that I'm working with the next one. So it's difficult to generalize. And if I have to explain the research based on each project. Like, for instance, with an abortion, it's quite journalistic in the way that I have to find a lot of people. I have to find a lot of stories that were hidden, which is very different than on rape, which I have to pretty much filter millions of stories. So I always use this kind of analogy of me being the filter of this very raw, tough reality. Yeah, but it's a filter that is very subjective, no? It's very personal. It's not objective. So that's why I try to disattach myself from the journalistic practice, which is different. But at the end of the day, it's my research journey. It's my and what you see when you look at my project, it's a little bit of a glance of my own mental trip or my emotional trip through this subject that I believe it's important for me and for many people to take a look, because maybe we haven't taken a look properly, or we did take a look, but we forgot about something, or it's, you know, it's 2020 and something else has come up. So I'm also very much conscious of people around me and the audience. It's not obviously only about me. It's also about finding those holes where people might be confused about information and there is a lot of misunderstanding around it. So that's, I guess that's a little bit connected to the journalist background. But at the end of the day, you know, we do this for ourselves. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. I heard you talk about how with On Rape, you worked with psychologists and lawyers as part of your dialogue with the subjects. And I know you've talked before about sort of numerous experts, scientists, different people that you've drawn upon to help you, I guess, explore or examine the sort of real nuances within some of these subject matters, which are so, so vast. Has that been quite an important part of your process as well?
Yeah, I mentioned it for On Rape because I thought it was important, because there is this kind of narrative around documentary photography that our subjects come to us because they kind of look for this catharsis. And I was speaking with this very, very good psychiatric, and she was telling me, be careful with this idea of this catharsis, because you don't know what's going to happen once you leave the room. And you don't know that person's background in terms of, you know, like their mental health. And it could be actually very dangerous. And that was really important, really humbling, and really, and it made me realize that for this particular chapter, in some specific cases, I would need to have this kind of translator, like in a way also sometimes a real translator, because it was from countries I don't speak the language, but also like translating my questions so I was not triggering, or translating my intentions so they would feel safe. And I work with different kind of characters, but psychologists and those kinds of mental health experts are always been around my practice, because since I started with On Eating Disorders and since I started myself, I always have been a lot of influence from psychology. And I don't really talk much about it until lately because of that chapter, but also because I have a feeling people, it's a little bit more interested in mental health, or have a need of artists or documentary photographers or people creating hard content to be real about it, because obviously that, you know, there is an aspect of it that also affects my personal and my direct life. So it's something that for me it's very usual and very normal, but I guess not many people talk about it.
Yeah, it's all part of the wider accountability, right? Which is something that has always been present, but this evolution from kind of what the documentary practice used to stand for and how that's shifting, and where perhaps we need to evolve some of the ethics and approach around that. It's really interesting.
It is, because, you know, I haven't really given it a thought, but lately that we've been asked about post-truth and, you know, all those things. And I'm disattaching again myself because I'm in a different search, basically. I also realized, like, why I felt the need to break all those documentary rules, why I started doing appropriation, why I started doing reconstruction, why I started to break that mold. And it was not a matter of being rebel. It was just those guidelines or those strategies were very useful for the kind of topics that they were proposing as the news. They were saying that was the news. And the kind of topics that I want to see in the magazines, or kind of topics I wanted to document, they were not only not appearing there because of patriarchy, but also because the system or the documentary photography guidelines were not really open to those kinds of stories. And as an example, like psychological in-depth complex stories, it was like effectivity, no? Like a visual effectivity in a way. My images are not effective in terms of having them in a newspaper. You need a lot of time to understand what you're looking at. You need a lot of time to read. I'm asking you a lot of your time and your energy. And obviously that does not match the news, and that does not match the way we were communicating. And obviously I'm not saying I'm the only one or that, you know, not people were not doing that. Obviously there were people doing that, but I'm just talking like mainstream way of communication.
I'm interested to talk about kind of a history of misogyny and kind of this idea of an umbrella theme and how it kind of emerged for you. Was there a sort of genesis or a particular moment which was a catalyst for that idea?
Yeah, I guess the chapter thing, it's just like a reaction. I'm the generation that we were watching Lost, no? It was the first pre-Netflix generation where for once we were getting our storytelling in episodes. So I think that kind of influenced a little bit. But if I have to be honest, what scared me the most was the idea that I have to spend 15 years photographing the same thing in the same way. I thought that was just like not what I wanted to do. So in a way, chapterizing the projects it would allow me to have these boxes in which I could choose different aspects of the topics, and I could also maybe use different ways of visualizing them or different platforms. So that was the starting point with on eating disorders. And once I finish it, I realize I have already done a lot of research parallelly on subjects connected to sexuality, to women's rights, but they were not structured as on eating disorders was structured. So that plus the fact that, again, I have a lot of resistance from platforms or from the media or from people, like not really wanting to pay attention to the stories that I wanted to tell, I decided that to start a new long-term project. And the concept of this umbrella, the historical umbrella, it was just a matter of proving people that what they were telling me was not true. Like they were telling me, especially in Spain, well, you know, those problems belong to the past, or that only happens in other countries, whatever that means. And I was researching, I was seeing that was not true, you know, and it was doing very shallow research. It was not like in the depth that I work now. So that was the reaction. The reaction was like, let me show you that this is not connected to time. Let me show you that this is not connecting to other countries. Let me show you that this could happen tomorrow. And actually it did, because when I first started researching, it was 2015, and it was pre-campaign for Donald Trump. And if you take a look to history and you take a look to human rights, you know, they are not from worse to good. they're pendular, and it was quite obvious what was going to happen. And indeed, I mean, I was not myself discovering, you know, the philosophers and historians and economists and human rights experts were already seeing it coming. So I guess it was a reaction to that, and it allowed me to also work in the way that I needed, which was specifically different for each topic that I wanted to approach.
Let's talk a little bit about chapter one on abortion, because that for me was a real kind of gut-wrenching exploration of the repercussions of not having access to abortion, and also really raises questions about the ethics and morality of the subject, while sort of revealing this disarming series of social triggers, stigmas and taboos, as you say, that have long remained invisible. And so much is examined in this work. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about your production process and how the work is made.
Yeah, so the first time that I heard about this idea of not having access to abortion was actually around 2009, that I was working at Colors. And we were doing this issue about the sea. And I was looking for stories that they were not the typical stories. And I came across this boat from this Dutch organization called Women on Waves. So basically this boat has, you know, was sailing international waters, providing access to abortion procedures to women in countries where, you know, it was restricted. So that was the first time. And I remember not being able to reach the boat because something was going on with the law. The law was changing in the Netherlands. And that was it. And a few years later, when I was researching from a history of misogyny, on abortion was not really a chapter, but I have some of those stories already planned in my first research pitch. But the more I was researching about the subject, the more I realized it was incredibly important to talk about it. And there were not many news. Specific news talking about it, but the reports and the statistics were really frightening, because more than 47,000 women were dying because of not having access to abortion, which is something we can easily, you know, fix. And when it's something that is very easily fixed, and it's a matter of a stigma, and it's a matter of politics, it really upsets me. So I thought it was interesting to take a look to that. But I guess the ticking point was the fact that in Spain, they, in 2013, 14, they wanted to restrict the law to like the one we have maybe in the 70s. And they didn't manage to do it, but they did manage to restrict it, for instance, in people under 18. So that was really impressive for me, because even though you're open-minded and a citizen of the world and traveling all the time, still there is something when it attacks home, no? And you never expect it. Once things are okay, you never expect them to go wrong or to go backwards, but they do. And after that, I started to research and I started to find very insane stories around it. And I have an opportunity that it was really, really important for me, because I have an invitation to have a show in Arles in the festival on the south of France. And this was pre-Me Too. And I think that's important to say, because I was, I think, not even 30. I was 29 years old. And I was invited to have a solo show about a subject that no one wanted to talk about it. And I decided to start with on abortion because of the urgency of the topic. But it was kind of a crazy decision, because I haven't yet take almost any picture. So I have to do everything in 9 months, which is, you know, even a little bit funny, but also like crazy. but because it was a huge opportunity, not obviously only for the subject, but also for my career, but especially for the subject, because of, you know, I could have wait one more year if it was for my career. But it was, Trump was happening. Actually, it happened in the middle of the process. And I, you know, I felt that it was now or never. And that's why I decided to do it. And that's how it was born. It was born with this first show. It was also the first time that I was working with an exhibition as a main platform, because before, obviously, I have done shows, but my main platform was more editorial, were books or even short documentaries. But it was the first time that it was an installation, and this space was actually deciding how to show it and what to show. So that was also a very big change, and also the starting point of a history of misogyny.
On Abortion includes this series of portraits and testimonies of strong survivors, some of them really putting themselves at risk to be a contributor or collaborator in the project. And I wondered how you manage the responsibility of those dynamics.
Yeah, it's quite emotional, actually, to be honest, this week or this last month, because even though I should also embrace the good news for the fact that recently they also managed to change the Spanish law, and now we are back to 2013, when, you know, the law was more accessible. I started in Poland because it was in Europe and it was really, really restrictive. And it was not very dangerous at the time, so I thought it was a good starting point. And I started talking to the people who would collaborate and creating these photo novels. And only like a few weeks ago, you know, there is a massive tragic situation right now in Poland, because it's women are in the streets and men are in the streets. They are demonstrating. There are riots because they want to make the law even more restrictive, which doesn't even, I don't know, I've even thought was possible. I mean, I should, because, you know, I've seen many things happening in that sense. But I was not expecting it, especially after 5 years, like I've been working on the subject. You might not have hope to get things better, but at least not have things worse, no? So it's quite emotional in that sense. But yeah, like when I was photographing on abortion, it was very, very important to making the audience understand and transmitting to the audience that they were not victims. They are very, very strong women who exercise their right in a clandestine situation often, and that make them very strong. And they make also really proud, and they were really proud of themselves. So it was very important for me to not portray them in a very paternalistic, victimizing way. You know, like I really wanted to avoid that image of them from the back looking through the window. They were extremely strong, wise, smart women. So photographing them in a very raw, straightforward, looking in the eyes, you know, this kind of, as you say, this kind of very strong portraits, it was really important to me. Because, you know, I have made that mistake before. And I guess that's why this organic way of looking back to the projects and understanding what you've done wrong and what you've done right it was really helpful in this case because I didn't want to make that mistake again. I didn't want to project this collective idea or even my personal idea to the portrait. In this case, my personal vision, it was kind of aligned to what I saw from them. But, you know, that is strategy of having them as delicate victims is the strategy that we've been using for this kind of subjects for many, many years. So that was very important. And you know, mostly of them were activists or they were very much connected they knew that it was very important to talk about it. So we shared that kind of responsibility in a way. But obviously, since politics are changing all the time, I have to be very careful about where to show it and how to show it. And I do have that responsibility. My characters and my subjects are the most important thing of my project. And even though the ones that they are not portrayed and they don't actually show their faces, even like the ones on rape, are a key element of everything I do. And I do have a lot of responsibility and I feel a lot of responsibility and I do have a lot of respect from the fact that they are sharing the story, especially in 2020. And you would say, well, should be the opposite, no? Because now everybody shows and shares their life online. But I think now it's harder than ever to being able to control the way we consume those stories. And that I think that's why also exhibitions and installations are a space that I really like to use to tell these personal stories, because in a way force you to spend time and force you to be quiet and force you to interact in a way often, you know, the phone or the computer, it makes it a little bit more shallow because obviously it's faster, you know, and we are consuming information on and on, on and on. And there is something about the space in the room that you share in a public space, in a public experience, in front of these stories that I think it kind of like makes you be more respectful, and I do appreciate and enjoy that kind of process within the people reading the stories and looking the project.
You're listening to The Messy Truth, Conversations on Photography.
I feel like that really comes true in how you present on rape in terms of the series of life-size images of clothing that belongs to some of your subjects, which support the written testimonies. It feels like that was a really powerful yet sensitive way to address that element of that chapter, but also it's very visually intriguing. You're kind of a master at the visual intrigue and hooking the viewer in to what is a very difficult subject matter.
You know, with the dresses, we only have had like few shows and the book is still on its way, but it's, and I haven't talked much about it because of the pandemic happened in the middle, no? But actually what is how this idea was born is because, you know, with an abortion, it was the opposite. With an abortion, I didn't really know the face of a person who have had an illegal abortion. But with on rape, it was the opposite. Like it was in the middle of Me Too movement. And finally, testimonies of survivors were happening in mainstream media in a more regular basis. But what I realized is like, that was it. Like we were putting all the pressure in those people. And I was a little bit worried about the fact that we were not actually putting the pressure in who I thought we should be putting the pressure. And what I realized while I was researching, it was like in Spain, we have our kind of Me Too movement because of a very important case. It's called La Manada. And basically what happened is like these five men gun raped this woman and they filmed it. And it was a long trial. And they were not, at the beginning, they were not condemned with rape, but with only abuse, because he was not showing a struggle or resistance in that video. And I was so shocked of how the system was failing her. I was not even thinking about the fact that she was also raped, obviously, but also like, you've been raped, you've been gun raped, and after, this system, this democratic system is failing you to this level of insanity that I started to realize about this, the concept of rape culture, how these institutions were not only allowing this to happen, but even promoting this to happen. And obviously I started to research the laws and the marriage and the school and the church and the military and prisons, and realizing about all these stories that I wanted to tell of people being failed by the system and by these institutions and by this culture. So the dresses are not only to prevent from the survivors to have this pressure and this kind of second trial on how they behave, but also a way to facing ourselves and to these institutions, no? And when you arrive to the room and you see all these dresses, the dresses symbolize these institutions. Obviously, you have the testimonies, and the testimonies are on top of them. And unfortunately, the testimonies are pretty much representing millions of people at the same time, because this is a massive problem. But the dresses have this binary effect in which you're also looking at the institutions and kind of hold them accountable of failing them. Especially, I have this testimony that it really, really breaks my heart. It was this very young mother who I was talking to from Colombia, and she discovered that her 4-year-old child was being abused by the teacher, and she started to investigate, and she realized it was not only her, but it was pretty much everyone in the class. There was around 25 children. And the way the school and the director of the school, who by the way was a woman, and the way politicians and social workers, everybody was just trying to silence her. That was absurd, because, you know, it's what I say. You even forgot about the person who is doing the abuse. And I even get more upset to the system that this silent this woman, but also pretty much allowing this man to keep doing the thing in other schools after they move him. So when you look at the testimonies, you would realize it's actually not about rape in this case. Obviously, they talk about it, but they don't talk about they being raped. They talk about how the system failed them afterwards.
I found a lot of culture, TV and film in particular, who are also kind of reinforcing this allowance of sexual misconduct. And I think they're making these shows under the guise of trying to, you know, expose these systems. But actually, I think in making it, you know, this dramatic interpretation and kind of glamorizing it also ends up reinforcing that you can get away with this. And I find it so triggering. And for me, like, this is why your work is so valuable, because for so many women, you know, we're constantly existing in the world with the tangible threat of violence. Like, even if it's a subconscious thing, in terms of you're conscious of the spaces that you enter and how you move through the world. And I have so much rage about these injustices. This work really profoundly affected me. And I'm just wondering how you navigate this constant revisiting of, like, the physical, literal and emotional weight of this subject matter that you're moving through, and kind of how you take care of yourself. Because I think if it was me, I would just be constantly angry.
Yeah, well, that's pretty much it. You know, when I mentioned about on abortion being easy to fix, in a way, obviously it's not easy, but it's possible. What did really make me hopeless on rape was the fact that the statistics. It was not even about this little girl being abused by her teacher that it just, you know, infuriated me the most. But the statistics make me hopeless, because it's such a massive issue that I'm obviously not going to see the end of it in my lifetime. So I have to focus in the aspects that I have a feeling they were fixable. Like, for instance, you know, holding accountable our institutions. So the process was, what you say is quite important, because it actually affects pretty much also the way I work and my methodology. Like, for the first time, I was not even able to be cold enough to, you know, be as conceptual as I like to be sometimes, because with an abortion, the idea is that my audience, or the audience I had in my mind, was people who maybe were against abortion. And I like it to talk to this kind of gray area, men or religious people, or people who are not really interested in the subject. And in order to do that, I decided that the images were quite sober. They were quite welcoming to them to have a conversation. Obviously, the text after, they were really rough, but I wanted them to stay in the room as much as possible. And with rape, I didn't manage to do that. Like, I got really upset. And in this particular case, the historical component, instead of being a comparison between the present and the past, as I did with an abortion, I use it in order to understand where was this coming from. Like, I track back the laws, I track the origins of the rape culture. This is the second part of the project, so I could understand why this was happening. And in a weird way, that gives me some kind of peace, like understanding this just doesn't happen because obviously there is a root, is what gives me a little bit of peace. And that's why I did it that way. But while I was researching, while I was working, and you're totally right, like, we just realized how much the rape culture affects our daily lives. It's actually called rape schedule. All the things you do or you don't do in your daily life in order to not get, to prevent sexual harassment or sexual abuse or sexual misconduct, is actually an internalized rape schedule that we just, learn since kids. So obviously that made me really, really upset. And I think it affects a lot in the way that I'm working, or I'm going to work in my next chapters, because this kind of reacting to the research, it took a toll on my mental health as well. And I guess I need to stop documenting only the dark aspects of this project or these topics, because I get it older as well, and I just want to the next generation to take over somehow, because it's been 10 years and obviously a little bit more than 10 years, and you everybody has a limit, no? And I think I kind of, even though people say that you get numb, I don't think things affect me less than before. I think things affect me more than before. I'm better at manage them, and I'm better at asking for help, but it affects me more because they add to it. It's not like, I don't get numb. I can get numb. It's my work is actually being empathic to the extreme that I feel what they are feeling. Obviously, I'm never going to feel what they are feeling, but that's the idea of being this filter. So at the end of the day, when you were photographing this little dress of this four-year-old girl from Colombia, it has a very big impact on my health. So you have to be okay in order to make proper these projects, because they are very complex psychologically speaking. And rage is an important element that motivates people often to get on the streets and to detonize change. But in my particular work, I prefer conversation. And I'm not saying it's better or worse. I'm just saying, these different approaches, different aspects, different levels, different ways of communicating. And in order to have a conversation, I can't be this upset. So, I think that kind of like impact a lot the future of my project. And the next chapters are going to be quite different in that matter.
Oh, I just want to hear more.
I don't really
I'll ask
know
you
how.
A little bit later. Okay. It's interesting that you say about conversation, because I was curious to hear your thoughts on audience and your relationship to your viewers, because I watched a talk recently where you said, you're really not looking for people to like the work. That's not what this is about. So I'm curious, kind of, what is that conversation that you want to start with them, and kind of how do you think about your relationship with the viewer?
Yeah, it's very interesting you say that, because it is only recent that I realized I don't need people to like it. Because when you start doing photography, or when I was working as a documentary photographer, even though people were doing also obviously rough stories, there was this component of people liking it. And it's really superficial, because also kind of messed up. How are you going to like this? No, like, it's not about liking it. It's going to make you uncomfortable. So you're probably not going to like it at all. So if the whole idea is that you're going to be uncomfortable, yeah, I'm looking for other things to share with you. And the audience, again, it's different in every chapter. And at the same time is everybody, because obviously I'm not only thinking in one particular target, but that particular target, it is shaping the way that I construct the story or the visual approach. So, and that's probably coming from my journalistic background. And that's really changing, actually. Like, the next projects are getting more personal. So obviously the audience is there, but I'm a little bit more a protagonist in some cases. So it's a balance. It's a conversation also between myself and the audience, and obviously the subject of the story. So that's constantly in my mind when I work, and it is very important for me. I don't do it this only for myself. At the end of the day, it's to have a conversation. And there is something quite interesting. Like, when I did On Abortion, the show, it took me a long time to do the book, because somehow I didn't feel like I was who I was, you know? Like, why I'm writing a book about abortion? I'm not an expert. I'm not a doctor. What's the point? Why I'm doing this? And that took a long time. And it was really interesting to have that space between both. Because now I try to do the same. Like, I have first the show, I'm now doing the book. And I realized that the conversations I was having with the people, the audience, the students, the journalists, helped me to understand what I have done. Because there is a little bit of it that you don't really know. You have this idea in your mind, you make the idea, but you don't really know what people actually is going to take from that. And I was looking forward actually to having these shows this year, and which I, you know, I have some, but obviously it's not the same with the whole pandemic. But I really need people to tell me what is that this is provoking them. And sometimes it's the idea that I have at the beginning, but sometimes it's a completely different thing. And I really enjoy that part. And then when I understood what's the function of what I'm doing and how affects people, it also affects decisions, for instance, in the book or on either other pieces or the next chapters. So it is very important for me to have that kind of feedback from people. And I have many kinds of feedback. Like, I always talk about the same story, but I really like it. And it's the fact that we have a show in 2017 in Slovenia. And I was doing this show in this gallery, and I was not there when this happened, but they took a picture of a visitor, and it was this nun, Catholic nun, and that was just, you know, seeing the show and apparently spending like 45 minutes inside. And it was really strange, because I was actually very worried about that show, because we were having it in the middle of the main square in Ljubljana, in the capital. And just a few weeks before, they were projecting this horrible images of fetus, like from the pro-life movement, because they were having elections, and the whole anti-abortion movement is quite strong over there. So the gallery is actually a glass gallery, so you can see what it's inside, and it's just near to the church. So I was quite worried about it, and it was fine, actually. But the fact that she was there, the fact that she was feeling comfortable enough to be inside of the room, it was what I was looking for. I'm not looking to change her mind. I mean, obviously, that's a very complex thing, and we don't even know what she thinks about it. But it was very important to me it was as important to make the show as having the show in the places I wanted to have them. For instance, Ireland, it took me 3-4 years to have the show in Ireland. US, it took me 5 years to get finally the show in US. Mexico, where it's illegal, and, you know, Zagreb, like Croatia. I was really much looking forward to have those conversations in those places. And that's as important as making the pictures for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I had no idea that was a glass gallery where you see the nun. That really adds a different element to that.
Yeah,
that gesture that she was there.
Especially because they did this kind of cut vinyl with the title in the glass, with a massive typeface saying "On Abortion." And I was really worried.
Wow.
Yeah, but it was fine. It was actually a very nice opening.
That's amazing. you know, it's really fascinating what you just said, because we're really living in an era, particularly this year, where we're really looking at art and photography and asking more, you know, asking what more can it do and how can it better to support our world in a more positive way, and how can it perhaps graduate from its legacy, which was negative and, you know, almost weaponized, really was weaponized. And I wondered how you see your role as the author of your work. You know, do you see it having an activist element? Does it have a sort of humanitarian agenda for you, or do you see it in a very different way?
You know, this is always a very tricky question, also because I realized lately this activist label is very different from one country to another. Like, it's not the same when you say it, I'm an activist in US or in UK, than in Spain or many other countries. So I always refuse to have that label, because my understanding of activism is very different from my work. I'm an artist, so my agenda is very different. At the end of the day, I do not have this specific goal of helping someone or like changing something in particular. Like, I'm offering an experience, I'm offering a reflection, I'm offering some content that hopefully it has an impact that is also aligned to those kind of ideas. But I really much respect the work of an activist, and I don't think I am. The same way I'm not a journalist. I'm not using the methodology of, you know, like telling facts and the truth in the way that journalists should. And in a way, it's for many reasons, but once overall is the fact that I want to have a freedom of being able to investigate and being able to produce content in a way that it's more aligned to my own thoughts and my own feelings. And that's, I believe, pretty different from the role of a journalist or an activist. But I don't think it's like a competition. I think that the idea is that it's a big puzzle and we all have our piece. And I'm just adding one piece to this big puzzle that hopefully take us to the obvious future that we want, which is a more empathic or holistic, organic and peaceful work. I mean, it's pretty basic at the end of the day. What I did realize at the beginning is that with communication, with photography, with text, I have a power, which means I have a responsibility to show things in a way that might make people understand that some of their prejudices or their taboos, they are pretty much only because they never actually stop to think or to see stories in a particular way. So when I realized I was quite okay or quite good, whatever you want to say, with very complicated stories or very tough stories, I suddenly felt that responsibility, or, you know, going to those dark places and showing you the result or the visualization of it in a way that, you know, you might suddenly see it from a different perspective. So it was very important for me to understand that, especially the history of documentary photography was a little bit, I was missing a little bit of, you know, I wanted to be a little bit more humble. Like, I didn't expect to have the impact that they taught me that I could have as a photographer, because, you know, this is not 1970s, and I don't think a picture can change the course of the world, because we have seen pictures that should have done that, like the picture of this little boy in the Mediterranean, like the refugee, and it did not change the you know, like, we have this romantic idea that it could. So I think it's important to be realistic about what is our role and what we can achieve. And I'm really, really grateful for an hour of her time, you know, spending there. And that's for me already a lot. And I don't create products that they are mainstream. So obviously the impact that I have, it's quite reduced to certain people who want to spend that time or that money or that effort. But that's okay, because there is other people who work with different targets or different strategies that hopefully, I don't know, like a Netflix movie, for instance, arrive to many, many more people. So I don't feel it as a struggle anymore. I used to. I just accept the limitations of the work. And I also try to trick them sometimes. For instance, working with multi-platform, obviously not everybody can buy a £40 book, and obviously not everybody has access to museums. But if you manage to work in different platforms, you know, you also have a larger audience, which at the end of the day, that makes sense for me, because, you know, it's a political humanitarian subject that I work with.
It feels like it's just so much about consciousness raising. It feels like that's really at the heart of the agenda of the work. Kind of, as you said before, it's about conversations. It's about trying to meet people both where they are, but take them somewhere else. I think the manifestations of the work being so multifaceted and multi-format, as you said, are so vital, because they have such a delicate way of balancing both the respecting the material while using design as a tool to kind of draw the viewer in and engage them, and also propose a pathway through the material to enable them to keep going, which is not easy because these are profoundly difficult and emotionally triggering subject matters. And there's also a lot of depth and information that you're asking them to interact with. And for me, design really heightens the experience of the work, whether that's digitally on your site or in print or in an exhibition context. And I wondered, you know, do you really enjoy that presentation element of your practice, because it just has so much energy?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is pretty much a methodology that we took and evolved from colors, and it's a matter of understanding that there is nothing above any other element. Like, design is, again, a tool, photography is a tool, like text is a tool, in order to create or an experience or a journey or like a presentation of the work that is gonna manage to reach the goals that we have in mind. So the design of the project does not come at the end of the process. It's present since the beginning. Like, I, especially nowadays, I create the shows or the projects thinking in the first space that I'm going to have, which is not the ideal decision, because afterwards you have to itinerate and it's a struggle. But that is the way that I've been working. And, you know, on abortion, the book, I realized I was having a hard time, because when I was working with the material, I realized everything that I've done was thought to be shown in a physical space and in a public experience. So when I was making the book, I realized if I had made the book the first platform, I would have photographed everything in a different way. So it's a matter of understanding and compromise, understanding the limits of the platform, the limits of the language, the limits of my own limits, the limits of the work, and you know, with that kind of box, trying to make the best thing possible. But yeah, like all these tools and elements, starting with the research is not a tool. The research is everything for me. The research is where I actually find the clues and the ideas and detonates the visuals and makes sense. And then the tools around me that sometimes I open and I experiment a little bit more, even like with sound installation or with installations. And that's, I guess, the more artistic interest of everything that is obviously also there. And, you know, like, I like to also explore things and learn things that are not only about death and people's struggle. I guess that's why I'm not, you know, in the humanitarian career. Yeah, so those elements are pretty much the methodology that I have. It's not a secondary step on the way. It's pretty much the first one at the beginning, like, is in my mind.
It's fully integrated in the whole process. It's interesting. What have been some of the biggest challenges to making the work? Is there anything you've had to unlearn along the way, or is there anything that you're kind of constantly butting up against, which you have to overcome?
Well, I guess a lot of things. I guess it depends on each project. It depends on each moment. Lately, as I already mentioned, it's a little bit much connected to the sense of everything, because it's really hard. You know, it's not only about the heaviness of the topic, but it's also complicated to make a living as an artist. And it seems sometimes that everything is against you. And if you don't really have a motivation that is really powerful, I don't think you actually make it. No, when I'm teaching or doing workshops or with my students, I'm always telling them, like, if you really need to find why you like to do this, and it should not be only connected to the ego issues. Ego issues are fine. Everybody likes to have win a contest or having a show or print a book it's a beautiful experience. But I don't think it should be the only thing, because if that's the only thing, once you accomplish that's it, because you're also not making a lot of money, and money is obviously important because this is your job. So yeah, like I need to have a deeper motivation to being able to do all of this as a lifestyle. And that motivation with what's going on in the planet right now and getting older, sometimes is a struggle, because you don't really see it as clear as when you were 21 years old and you were really excited about it and to start it. So yeah, that's pretty much, I guess, the biggest challenge in about the process and about the methodology or the learning process. I think that's actually is a big struggle as well, but I think that's actually something at the end of the day we enjoy. Like, for instance, with an abortion, in the middle of it, I have a crisis, a philosophical, ethical crisis. I've never actually asked myself until when is okay to have an abortion. I never have to. And those are painful moments, but those are the moments that make you grow as a person. And I think that's the beauty, one of the beautiful sides of our job, no? Like, to grow as a person. And thanks to my job, I have to have this very open mind, flexible way of seeing the world. And I do enjoy being that way. And I think that's a silver lining, no, of the whole thing. But yeah, I guess if you really ask me, and I have to be honest about it, I do struggle with photography, actually. Like, I always have a very much love and hate relationship with the medium. And I sometimes is the pain comes from there even more than from the actual topic.
That's interesting, because, you know, I think a significant byproduct of your practice is this questioning and testing of the limitations of photography as a medium, as well as kind of the documentary tradition. So it's interesting to hear you talk about that tension. Can you unpack that a little more?
Yeah, I mean, it's always been there. And I think at the beginning was hard. It was stronger and it was harder. Now I don't really label myself as a photographer. Like, I think I'm an artist working with photography. I would say my medium is more even research at this point of the journey. But I guess is what you say, like, the limitations of photography in order to tell the stories that I wanted to tell, it make me doubt that if the problem was me instead of the medium. And I'm obviously not saying it's not, like, I also have my obvious limitations with the medium, but it was a matter of unlearning what everything has taught me and understanding that that was a tool, that it was on my side, not against me. And now it's different. It's easier. I have a better relationship, but I have to de-romanticize. Like, you know, I think one of the biggest problems with documentary photography was this romanticization about the medium, that it was pretty much making us forget it was not about taking the picture. I mean, obviously it could be, and I'm not saying that's also possible. But when you are visualizing the pain of others, I don't think it should be about the picture. I think it should be about the pain of others. So yeah, I was upset with photography, but not with photography, the way we were using photography. And yeah, I think now it's the little painful processes of not achieving or reaching the way you want to do things. It's just normal artists kind of, you know, daily life, and that's okay. But it took me a long time to understand it was not only my fault, you know. And I pretty much see the new generation understanding that quite fast on their process of getting into photography, and I'm glad for that they are actually this we still should pay respect to the medium and learn about it and I think that that's important. But I think at the end of the day, especially when you're working with these kind of subjects and topics, it is important to see that that's not the most important thing of it.
Yeah, it's interesting that you talk about the younger generation, because I feel like I also grew up in the 90s, and I feel like we grew up in an era where photography's intentions and its past have been slowly unraveled through our lifetime. Whereas the generation now, you know, the cracks are so visible. It's a tangible conversation that people are having in terms of the limitations and you know, where it's, you know, continued as a weapon and a tool of harm in certain spaces around the world, and how it still does now in certain genres and in certain contexts. It is really interesting. I'm really excited to see how future generations rework the medium in exciting and sort of dynamic ways to overcome some of this.
Yeah, like I'm always been also in from this positive perspective. You know, when I graduate, it was 2008, and it was this economical crisis. But it was also a crisis in the medium and in journalism. No, the first digital cameras were happening, and it felt like everything was going to change. And actually, indeed, it changed, especially for the people who were working in a more traditional way. So I kind of, I'm not saying it's the same as having a pandemic when you graduate, but I feel a little bit, you know, like I see them. I see how they are scared and they are worried, and I completely understand, and I'm empathic with this next generation in that sense. And I always tell them, like, just focus in the silver linings. Like, I obviously it's different to work as a photographer in the digital era, but there is so much positive sides of it at the same time. And it's an interesting moment because in one hand, we have photography being one of the most important communication tools in history, because everybody has a phone and everybody's looking at pictures all the time, and everybody, you know, it's consuming photography more than ever. And in the other hand, we have this very big, as you say, holes and cracks in the way it's been used by the system and by the mainstream outlets. So I think basically education is going to be the answer for that, because as you said, photography, it is really powerful and at the same time dangerous, and at the same time, you know, as everything that is powerful in the world, it could be used for good or for evil. So I think teaching people to understand photography since they are in the school is going to be the only way for everybody to be able to be critic, no, with what we are looking at, instead of wanting to control that what we are looking at is true. I think it's more about teaching people to being critical and not in a like conspiracy way, but critical in a reflective way of like also taking the power and to ourselves to being able to understand what is that we're looking at. I think I've said this before, and I don't really remember if I made it up or I borrowed it from someone else, but I remember thinking about the fact that we from the 90s are the link generation. I remember when we were browsing the net, we were finding links and we have to open another window and then thinking about a connection and open another window. And this is, you know, linking things. The new generation is the scroll generation. You know, think about TikTok. It's just like scrolling, looking at things. And the way what you absorb that information, it's almost like no filter. It's just like it's giving it to you while we have to go to find it. And that wires the brain in a very different way. So we need to give them tools to protect themselves, to understand what is that you are consuming. And I think that's the key element, one of the key elements of the new generations, not only photographers, or I mean, everybody's a photographer actually, but not only people working with photography and communication, but to everybody.
Yeah, I agree. I think it just all comes down to visual literacy and really evolving and fine-tuning that.
Yeah.
For sure.
Having a conversations around photography when they are not actual photographers, I think that's important too.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to finish up by asking you the question that I ask everyone at the end of the show, which is, what matters more to you, the experience of making the work or the final manifestation?
Well, I think it's pretty clear. it's all about experience. Obviously, you want to have a good result. And I think why I want to have a good result is for the people to have an experience. Like, in a way, what I am giving to you, offering to you, it's to share my experience once I've done it. So in a way, for you, it's, I wouldn't say easier, but, it's open there for you to have access to. So it is about the process. It's not about only the result. And actually, when I do have the result, it's actually kind of like a grieving moment for me. Like, it's not anymore my baby, and now it's just out in the world for people to enjoy or judge or whatever happens to them, no? And it's actually sometimes even painful in a way. But yeah, like, as I say, sharing those moments in this podcast or in a show or in a class or when people talks about the book, it's also like a closing the circle, no, of the starting point of the journey. So in a way, it also balances.
I love that. Thank you so much, Lai. It was so great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Messy Truth. You can find more information about today's guests in the show notes. Theme music is Change by Judd Greenstein from the album Awake, and design is by Ruby White. You can follow updates on the podcast on my Instagram at Jem Fletcher or subscribe to my newsletter at jemfletcher.com. Feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.